Today on Maine Calling, a Maine Public Your Vote 2024 special. Election Day fast approaches. Today we'll hear from two incumbent candidates making their case for re-election, U.S. Senator Angus King and 2nd District Congressman Jared Golden. I'm Jennifer Rooks. I asked each candidate about current issues, including the war in Ukraine, how to bolster Social Security, and the fighting in the Middle East. We did not interview Austin Terrio, who is challenging Golden in the 2nd District. We contacted the Terrio campaign multiple times to take part in an interview, but no one there responded to our requests. We'll wrap up the hour with a conversation with UNH political science professor Andrew Smith. He's an expert on polling. Smith discusses how to differentiate good polls from bad polls and how the science of polling has changed. A Maine Public, Your Vote 2024 special is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth. From investments to trustee services, more at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is a Maine Public Your Vote 2024 special edition of Maine Calling. Today, we meet two of the incumbent candidates running for re-election. Senator Angus King is an independent and running for a third term as a U.S. Senator. Angus King, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Jennifer, always a pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Tell me about your decision to run for re-election for a third term. Why are you running?
Well, two or three years ago, Jennifer, I would have said I probably wouldn't run this time around. A couple of things have happened since. Number one, there's plenty left to do. As I travel the state, I keep hearing about high prices, about housing in particular, about childcare. All of those issues are still out there, and I hate leaving work on the table. Number two, what I have noticed is that a lot of the work we've done in the last 4 or 5 years has been bipartisan. It's been groups that are formed in the Senate, and I've been a member of many of those groups. But we're losing a lot of those people. We're losing the middle, the people who were the ones who were doing the negotiating and putting some of these deals together. Lamar Alexander, Bob Corker, Roy Blunt, and this year we're losing Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, and Mitt Romney. And I felt like I had an important role to play in that middle in the Senate. And then finally, there's just, I'm at a place now where I'm more effective for Maine. Whether we like it or not, this is a place, the U.S. Senate, that runs on seniority, and I'm accumulating some seniority. I now am chair of two subcommittees, and I have a lot of good relationships, which are also important to getting things done. So it's a combination of a lot left to do and the belief and feeling that I was in a good place to get those things done and to deliver for Maine and the country.
As you sit here today and think about your time so far, two terms, what would you say has been your greatest accomplishment for the people of Maine?
Well, that's a pretty fair question. And you added the people of Maine, so I'm going to start with some of those things. One of the very first bills I introduced when I got, well, actually, I'll mention two in the first year that I was there. One was on broadband, and the other was on negotiating for drug prices for Medicare. That was the year I entered. Now, the way things work, it takes time, it takes patience, and the timing has to be right. But in the past couple of years, both of those things have come to fruition. I worked on them, certainly. A lot of other people did as well. So the fact that we're now something close to 95% broadband access in Maine is astonishing. And that's the latest number I got from the Maine Connectivity Authority. The Inflation Reduction Act made the largest, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill, the largest investment in broadband in American history. It's going to essentially wire the country, and Maine being a big part of it. That rural broadband has been something I've been harping on for an awfully long time, going back to before I was in the Senate. And the other bill, as I mentioned, was negotiating drug prices. That finally happened in the Inflation Reduction Act, and it's already lowering prices for Medicare, saving them billions of dollars, and saving seniors money in terms of out-of-pocket costs. So those are two things I'd point out that were particularly beneficial to Maine. Interestingly, one of the most important things I've been engaged in wasn't strictly senatorial. In 2019, the Senate Armed Services Committee and the Congress generally passed a bill creating something called the National Cyberspace Solarium Commission. And it was a commission set up to design for the first time a national cyber strategy, because we were being attacked on all fronts. We were very vulnerable. And myself and along with a Republican congressman from Green Bay, Mike Gallagher, were the co-chairs of that commission. We had over 50 meetings, Jennifer. This wasn't something where we sat on the shelf. But the important thing is, of our something like 80 recommendations, as of this fall, almost 75% have been enacted into law. And I can say with a certainty that although we're certainly not totally safe, we never will be in the cyber realm, we're a hell of a lot farther ahead than we were 3 or 4 years ago. By the way, very few commissions have more than 10 or 15% of their recommendations enacted. So I'm very proud of the work that we did. So, you know, those are just a couple of things. The Great American Outdoors Act, I was in the midst of the negotiations that set up a significant fund to pay up deferred maintenance at the national parks, made Land and Water Conservation Front permanent. That is being acknowledged as probably the most important conservation bill in the last 50 years. So a lot of those kinds of things, battery storage, the world's largest battery is being built in Maine, and it's going to make a real difference in our electrical future. So those are all things that I've been working on. I can go down the list, but those are some highlights.
Let's look forward. If reelected, what's your first priority?
I think the first priority has to be housing, Jennifer. It ties in with so many other things. Housing is a real problem in Maine and across the country. And by the way, it's not just in the cities, it's in rural areas as well. I know employers who are having a hard time getting workers because the workers can't find a place to live or a place that they can afford. So I've been working on this for 3 or 4 years, but now I think I've got 7 bills pending. One I'm most excited about was just introduced 2 weeks ago. My co-sponsor is a guy named Jerry Moran, who's a Republican senator from Kansas. It's called Farmhouse to Workforce. And basically what it would do is create or fully fund a program to renovate a lot of these older farmhouses that you see all over Maine once you go outside of town, where often there's an elderly couple, give them a source of income, 2 or 3 workforce apartments, and that could really dent the housing problem in rural Maine. So housing is number one. I think border security is something we got to get done. I voted for, I think, every border security bill that's come along. We had a really strong bill last winter, bipartisan. The lead Republican negotiator was James Lankford, who's one of the most conservative members of the Senate, a senator from Oklahoma, most knowledgeable about the border. It was endorsed by the Border Patrol Union, not exactly a liberal bunch, and it was the strongest, it was characterized as the strongest border control bill in 40 years. Unfortunately, the former president at the last minute pulled the plug, said, I don't want this. I want the issue to run on in November. I don't want Biden to have a success. I can't operate that way. I want to get things done. And I'm hoping when we get back, it's one of the things that's going to be on the agenda and we can actually get it done. In Maine, one of the most important things is childcare. It's becoming, in fact, a friend of mine characterized it in a way I'd never thought of before. She said for a family with that both work and a couple of kids, 2 and 6, not having childcare is just like not having the road in front of your house to get to your job. You can't work if you don't have childcare. And I've been very proud of the work I've done with the Bath Y and the Bangor Y, BIW, on childcare, because I think that's going to be one of the major issues of the next 10 years. Reproductive rights, electricity costs, all of those things, I think, are on my agenda.
As you well know, discussions about age have been at the center of the presidential race. You are 80 and would be 86 at the end of this next term. Is it appropriate to look at age as a factor? And what do you say to voters who might be uncomfortable electing someone who's two decades past the typical retirement age?
Well, I think it's a very fair question. And it is, you said, is it appropriate to look at it? And I think the answer is yes. The first thing I would point out, Jennifer, just to make it very clear, I'm a year younger than Mick Jagger, just so you know. And Mick Jagger's still rocking. I saw him at Gillette Stadium about 2 months ago. But seriously, people age differently. If I didn't feel up to it, I wouldn't be doing it. If I was tired, I wouldn't be doing it or doing the traveling that I'm doing around the state or around back and forth to Washington. I feel great. I've got the energy, and I feel like I've got something to contribute. If, like I say, and we all know, people age, their genetic makeup is such that they age differently. I seem to have my mother's side genes. My grandmother lived to 102, my mother to 96. And so I feel great. If I didn't, I absolutely wouldn't be doing this. It's a fair question, but I don't think an arbitrary limit makes sense because everybody's different.
We're coming up on the one-year anniversary of the horrific shootings in Lewiston, in which 18 people were killed, 13 injured. Since that time, have you changed your stance on assault weapon legislation? Would you now support a ban on assault weapons?
I introduced the strongest assault weapon bill about 6 months ago with a guy named Martin Heinrich from New Mexico. It's called the Go Safe Act. And basically what it does is ban the real problem with assault weapons is the high capacity magazine. The shooter in Lewiston had, I think, 30 bullet magazines taped together, something like that. So he could just keep shooting. Our bill would say a maximum of 10 bullets in a magazine that's permanent, that can't be just flipped out and flipped back in again. My friends at Sportsman's Alliance don't like it. But it's to me, it's just a common sense way to try to do something about this. And the other piece, though, at Lewiston, Jennifer, is the brain damage to the fellow that did the shooting. It's now been established that he had been exposed to hundreds, if not thousands, of explosions during his time in the Army Reserve, and it affected his brain. They've examined it in Boston and shown significant damage. So some colleagues and I in Washington have a bill. In fact, it's in the Armed Services bill that's pending. Hopefully we'll get done after November to have the Army pay much more attention to what they call blast overpressure in terms of preventive gear, trying to minimize the impact of this, and also importantly to screen soldiers at the beginning, just like they do high school athletes, for a kind of baseline in terms of concussion protocol to determine if something's going on. I had a call with the Secretary of Defense about a month ago, and I said, look, this is almost an exact quote. I said, you've done all the studies. You know this is a problem. What I'm looking for now is action. I want to be sure that we are paying attention to this issue, that it's being worked, and that people with demonstrating some of these problems are going to be adequately treated. So a combination of a limitation on the weapons that are being used in these shootings and dealing with, in this case, not only mental health, but a true organic mental problem have got to be part of what we work on.
Senator King, what can the U.S. do at this point to help bring peace between Israel and its neighbors?
Boy, how long have you got, Jennifer? It's one of the most complicated problems I've ever experienced. I've been to the Middle East a number of times, both to Israel, Jordan, the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia. It's so deep-seated and complex. What I think the U.S. can do is continue to put its weight behind trying to bring the parties to some kind of table to discuss where we go from here. My problem with Prime Minister Netanyahu's position is that he doesn't even want to talk about a two-state solution. In my view, without a two-state solution, you're talking about perpetual war. You're just going to have a constant kind of Hamas, Hezbollah tension and occasional violence. And of course, the last year has been more than occasional. It's been awful violence. So we've got to figure out how do we get to a lasting peace. And I think the U.S. has got to continue to just try to lead these negotiations, push on Israel, work with the Gulf states, and push back on Iran, where a lot of this is coming from. If it were easy, we would have done it. But I know that the Secretary of State has spent a lot of time over there. But I think it's time to make clear that there has to be some conclusion of this, that the ongoing violence in Gaza is not serving Israel well. And of course, I'm worried now about a wider war in Lebanon or with Iran. So I think we've got to have people step back from the brink and think about how do we solve these problems long term. And that's the direction I've tried to move in. I told Prime Minister Netanyahu directly, I was at a table sitting right across from him, and said, this was last winter, that your bombing campaign in Gaza is doing more harm to Israel than it is to Hamas. On the other hand, Hamas is no, that's no Sunday school either. October 7th is the anniversary of that horrendous massacre that they perpetrated. Here's an interesting fact, for example, in terms of Hamas, those tunnels that we hear about and read about that were built in Gaza, if they were made a straight line tunnel, they'd go from Portland to Philadelphia. Think of what that infrastructure could have done, what that money could have done for the Palestinian people in Gaza instead of turning it into a fortress. So, long answer, but it's a complicated problem.
All right. Well, Senator King, thank you for joining us. Angus King running for United States Senate as an independent.
Thanks, Jennifer. Great to be with you as always.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is a Maine Public Your Vote 2024 special edition of Maine Calling. Now we'll hear from Jared Golden. Golden is a former U.S. Marine, a Democrat, and is seeking a fourth term representing Maine's 2nd Congressional District. Jared Golden, thank you for joining us, and welcome back to Maine Calling.
Good to be back, as always.
The big question, why are you running for re-election?
Well, I want to continue to represent the people of Maine's 2nd Congressional District in the United States House of Representatives. I'm proud of the work that's been done the last 6 years that I've been a part of, and also proud of the approach that I've taken, which has been very thoughtful, pragmatic, seeking to find compromise whenever possible, strong when I feel like I must be for the good of the people that I represent. There's some things that I still feel motivated to accomplish that haven't been done. And I've seen some successes come home finally in the last couple of years. So since the last election, the delegation finally got a 6-year freeze on right whale regulations that were going to be very damaging to Maine's lobster fishery. But we actually tried to get 10 years. We were able to get 6 as a compromise, but that time is going to go by pretty fast. So I'd like to see more time added to that as we try and figure out what's really going on and get better data and protect the lobster fishery. Just this year, finally, I was able to go to the ribbon cutting of a new substance use and co-occurring mental health treatment facility for veterans in Maine. That's something I've been working on since I was in the State House. And I successfully got that facility approved in the fall of 2020 in my first term in Congress. But there was a lot of red tape in the way. So, you know, it took us, even from having it approved, almost 4 years to finally get to a place where it's about to be open and taking in veterans to who are in crisis, right, to get them the care that they need. So I share that story just as a way of saying, like, this business is sometimes slow. You have goals in mind, and you got to be resilient and really keep plugging away at it.
I was planning to ask you as my second question, what you're most proud of, what accomplishment you're most proud of. Is it that, or is there something you'd like to add to what you've told me about already?
I mean, that facility for vets, when I first got elected to represent Lewiston in the State House, one of the first public meetings I went to as an elected official was a meeting of veterans from the kind of Androscoggin, you know, greater Androscoggin area, and that issue came up. The lack of inpatient care beds in Maine in the VA healthcare system, and so I started working on that almost immediately. So yeah, that I'm very proud of finally seeing that through and getting that done. I'm frustrated that it took 10 years.
You said there's more left to do. What is on that list? What is on that short list of what needs to be done right away?
I'm going to keep continuing with certain other related goals I've had. You know, I passed some bills through the House for our tribes here in Maine. Of course, it didn't get through the Senate. We may pick that work back up. Of course, that's got to be complemented by state action as well. So I really work in consultation with the tribes on the right approach and strategy there. I want to continue to focus on earmarks in the budget that I think are really important. I've tried to put money into the bucket of apprenticeship and training programs, often through the community college system. Like we've done that for the Loggers Master Apprenticeship Training Program. Got about $1 million up to Northern Maine Community College for that. Got money for a welding training facility. Got some for Husson for a new lab, STEM-related in their nursing program. And so I want to continue to focus on that. I think that's an important issue here in the state. And not super exciting, but I've really put a lot of money towards wastewater and like sewer treatment facility upgrades. When I was in the legislature, I heard from people who were talking about how old all that infrastructure is around the state, and a lot of towns just don't have the money to do it. And so I've been trying to dedicate a lot of money towards that. And obviously it's important for health, for the well-being of our environment, preventing leaks and other pollution that can take place when those facilities age. But it has to be done. It's critical infrastructure, but it's pricey, and it comes at a high cost for property taxpayers if it's paid for at the local level. So I think that federal investment's really important. And these are perhaps local, in the weeds, things that aren't super exciting to some people, but it's really important work that I enjoy working with towns to get done.
Among the top issues for voters right now, as you well know, prices, especially for groceries and housing. What can you do as a congressman to address these very real pocketbook challenges?
Well, talking more about things that I've been a part of, that I'm successes that I'm proud of, would be things that we did in the Inflation Reduction Act relevant to healthcare. So in that legislation, we finally made it the law that the U.S. government will negotiate directly for lower prescription drug prices. For starters, that's going to save the Medicare Trust Fund hundreds of billions of dollars over the next 10 years. And we know that there's a funding issue around the corner there, and this is going to help address that. But more meaningful for me and for the people of Maine is the healthcare savings going directly to Maine seniors. So in the district, we've got well over 100,000 people in Medicare, several thousand who have diabetes, and now, because of the IRA, have $35 insulin, which is a huge saving. We are, at this time, we, the federal government, are now negotiating, I think, the 10 or 15 most expensive medications under the Medicare program, but that's going to expand over the course of the next 6 to 8 years to as many as the 80 most expensive, and those savings will ultimately benefit all seniors. Starting on January 1 of 2025, out-of-pocket prescription drug prices will be capped at $2,000 for seniors who have had really expensive medications. They know how quickly They can go over that $2,000 limit, sometimes far in advance, you know, catastrophic almost cost. So that's going to be a huge savings. We've seen figures that show that there's going to be tens of thousands of seniors in Maine starting next year who will average between $100 and $500 in savings. And that law is also going to allow them to take those prescription medication costs and spread them out over 12 months so they have more of a fixed budget, a little easier to plan. It's very important. And then in that same law, we put subsidies in for middle-class families. About 30,000 families in Maine experienced about a $500 savings on their healthcare premium as a result of that law. So that's just one thing we can do to bring down prices in the here and now. And of course, I've talked about the need to reduce government spending, or at least to reduce the projected deficit, which is growing year by year. And we've actually done some work. Inflation Reduction Act was part of that, as well as the budget deal that was reached in the 2023 cycle to avoid the default on the debt, all making headway towards reducing our deficit, which is well out of hand and I think relevant to the issue of inflation and confidence of the Fed that they can go in the other direction, which they've now started to do by lowering interest rates, essentially acknowledging that inflation is slowing and in a place where we now have to look at the other side of the house and make sure that we don't see rising unemployment.
As you well know, an estimated 360,000 people in Maine depend on Social Security, with more people retiring every day. However, as you also know, the Social Security Trust Fund is being depleted and projected to run out in 2035. What measures do you support to bolster Social Security?
I think the strongest starting point to protect working middle class people is to look at the cap on contributions into Social Security through the payroll tax. So right now, you pay in on every dollar you earn up to $168,000 a year. And any income that gets earned in excess of $168,000 a year, there's no more Social Security contribution. If you were to lift that cap and then just apply it to every dollar earned for, I mean, when we're talking about $168,000, you know, households, we're talking about the very wealthiest households in the country, particularly in a place like Maine, and some people out there making millions per year. If we would just have them paying in the same that they do on that first $168,000, we could eliminate like 75% of that trust fund shortfall right there. And I think that's the biggest piece of the pie, and that's the best starting point for conversations about how to fix the budget problems with Social Security.
I know you've been asked this before, but I have to ask for our listeners, will you vote for Kamala Harris for president?
Well, you got to know I'm not going to answer that question at this point. I've been very consistent all along, and I think my message is very clear in this district, which is very competitive with a lot of split-ticket voting. I want my constituents to know that I respect their choices. If Donald Trump wins the election, I will respect that outcome. If Kamala Harris wins the election, I'm going to respect that outcome. But I want my voters to know that when it comes to their vote, I am 100% fixated on representing them, and I want their vote. And I don't care who they're voting for president.
This is interesting because many people on both sides believe that the 2024 presidential election is the most important in their lifetime. And you are going against the grain. You've got a hot take, Congressman Golden. You don't think so. Why not?
People said that the 2016 election was the most important. They said the 2020 was the most important. Now the 2024 is the most important. They're all important. They're all important. And so my feeling is that there is a almost kind of weariness, tiredness out there amongst the people, having these elections be so partisan, always told that this is high stakes, everything is going to fail if our people don't win and get elected, if the other side wins, democracy will fail. I just don't believe that's true because I have such faith in the American people and that they're going to do right by our freedoms and that they want democracy. And so I think that they are the ultimate deciders, but also the ultimate stopgap against any efforts to take away our democracy and our freedoms.
As you well know, unfortunately, we're approaching the one-year anniversary of the horrific shooting in Lewiston, your hometown. After the Lewiston tragedy, you changed your position on assault weapons. How has that affected your reelection campaign? What are you hearing when you go and talk to voters?
I think we're going to find out on the poll that matters most, which is Election Day. I don't know. You'd have to go talk to voters. After the shooting in Lewiston, I heard from people who had almost every reaction under the sun. You know, we need more regulation. We don't need any new regulation. We need to focus on mental health. I've heard people's thoughts and advice from almost every direction in this regard. I did what I thought was right in that moment, and I think through 10 years in office, 6 at the federal level and 4 in the state house, that I've always been very nuanced and understood that when it comes to the Second Amendment, it's very important. I am strongly in support of the Second Amendment, but you got to find a balance between protecting the individual right and the duty of providing for public safety. And it's a very delicate balance. And actually, my voting record through 10 years reflects my pragmatic effort to find the right balance.
We just marked another anniversary, which is, of course, the one-year mark since the coordinated Hamas attack. The last time you joined us on Maine Calling, you expressed your unequivocal support for Israel. That was a few months ago. Given the escalation of the conflicts and what's happened now in Lebanon, are you concerned about a widening war? And what do you believe the U.S. ought to be doing?
I think that the United States should continue to support Israel. I am concerned about a widening of the war, but I don't blame Israel for that. Hezbollah is a terrorist organization that is also targets American citizens in the United States of America. They are essentially funded and backed by Iran, who is also hostile to United States interests in the region and around the world. Hezbollah has been setting up hundreds of thousands of rockets on the southern border of Lebanon, on the northern border of Israel, for many, many years now, always intending to attack Israel, waiting for the moment. And apparently they feel that that moment is now. So I think we got to be strong in supporting our ally, Israel.
I'm sure you've heard from many, many voters that they're tired of the hyper-partisanship right now in the country. And I'm wondering where you see opportunities for bipartisan solutions in the next, if you go back to Congress, what issues can we, as voters, hope to see some bipartisan solutions for? What big issues?
And this gets back a little bit at the presidential race, Jennifer, from my perspective. I think people want their local, you know, issues, their local opinions to inform what their representatives do at the federal level and want the debate to be centered on those issues rather than the national conversation kind of coming in and forcing itself upon local voters and the people who are going to be making choices. I started thinking that actually in 2020, because I, you know, at that time we had the presidential election, a very expensive U.S. Senate race, and then my race. And I heard a lot of people, it's anecdotal, but they were saying things to me like, all of these hundreds of millions of dollars of advertisements, and somehow it leaves us feeling invisible. None of it is talking about us. And I really took that to heart. And I think people obviously are tired of the partisanship. On working together, actually, this Congress has been quite bipartisan. It's the first time that I can think of where, you know, the House of Representatives is often known as a body that is majority rule, and yet we have a Republican majority where most of the major work that has been done because it had to be done, funding the government, aid to Ukraine and Israel, most of that work has been a minority of the majority and a majority of the minority voting together in a bipartisan way to govern. So despite the you know, attention that gets given to the kind of loudest, most partisan voices, we're actually operating in a very bipartisan way in this current Congress.
All right. Well, we're almost out of time, but I'll ask you a question I know you'll probably answer very quickly. Would you support what Kamala Harris has proposed, which is codifying the rights that women had under Roe in legislation?
Yes. Yes, certainly. I hope that we have the votes to do that.
Jared Golden is Maine's 2nd District Congressman and is running for re-election. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is a Maine Public Your Vote 2024 special edition of Maine Calling. To wrap up our coverage this week, we talk with Andrew Smith, who directs the UNH Survey Center. He's a professor of practice, political science, and international affairs at the University of New Hampshire. Hi, Andy. Welcome back to Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Good to see you.
So many of us are following polls closely. How confident are you in the polls you see, and I'm going to say especially for the presidential race, the polls that you've seen that are not your own?
Well, I'd say I am cautious about trusting any given poll, and for many reasons. I think I'd start with the idea that polls are simply a snapshot. All of the polls that were showing that this race is going to be a close race, and that focusing on the poll that you like the outcome of is a very dangerous spot to be in. For campaigns, I think they should presume that they're always losing. And if you're a voter and your candidate's losing in the poll, that gives you a reason to get out and vote. But seeing the polls as a precise indicator of where the race stands or how people are likely to vote, I think is kind of not silly. It's certainly human nature, but it's really a fuzzy indicator. Polls are nowhere near as accurate as many folks presume they are.
So how has polling changed in recent years?
Well, polling is in the midst of what I would call a paradigm shift in its methodology. And I would compare the situation that we're in right now, which is moving from telephone polls to web-based polls, to the same movement that happened in the 1960s and 70s when the industry moved from in-person surveys to telephone surveys. It took 10 to 15 years to develop the methodological backing for being able to do those telephone surveys. And the main reason that we moved from in-person to telephone was, first off, speed. You can do them much more quickly on telephone than you can sending people all over the country to do in-person surveys. But secondly, cost. Telephone surveys are far less expensive than in-person surveys. We're in a similar position right now with moving from telephone surveys to surveys over the web, much quicker, much less expensive, orders of magnitude. And I can talk about why that's the case. But the big thing is that we don't really have the methodology structure and the procedural structure to do web surveys in a consistent way. And the data that look at the accuracy of surveys based on the type of data collection that's being done, kind of all over the map. There's no indication right now that one particular type is better than another type, which leaves us as survey researchers in a kind of a quandary, because polling is certainly the one thing that people see most obviously in survey research. But it's a small part of the overall industry. What we're trying to figure out is how we can measure public opinion, how we can understand what people want or are thinking about in an accurate way, not just for election results, but for all sorts of policy issues.
I'm thinking, Andy, and maybe I'm a more skeptical person than others, but I'm thinking if somebody called me and wanted to ask questions, I would not answer them. If somebody sent me something over the internet and came into my email, I wouldn't answer it. I'm concerned about phishing. I'm concerned about personal information getting out. So is the subset of people who, I guess what I'm asking is the subset of people who actually answer polls, does that subset reflect the American public?
That's a major question. And I think there's a lot of evidence that it does not represent the overall public of the United States. So if you think about what you're talking about is what we call response rates. And that is the percentage of households that you call where you know it's a household, a real people live there. It's not a business, but the percentage of households you call in which you get a completed survey. When I first started doing survey research within universities back in the 1980s, our response rates were typically in the 80% range, 85% range. People thought it was a special thing to be called to participate in a poll. They were more than willing to give their opinions, and they were fairly rare because they were expensive. As time has gone on and technology has changed and we've got ways of screening out people on our phones from caller ID to now with cell phones, you can see exactly who's calling. You can see if it's reported phishing, but response rates have plummeted. And the decline in response rates now in national polls is around 5%, maybe 6% of households respond. In IVR polls, that's interactive voice response polls, which we call those robo polls, where a computer actually calls you, their response rates are below 1%. And web-based surveys are down into 3 to 4%. And there is considerable research that shows that the people who are willing to express their opinions to either a computer or write it online, or even to a telephone, by telephone to a real person, are significantly more interested and engaged in politics than those people who are not willing to respond. So we tend to now get those people on both the Democratic left or the Republican right who are much more politically savvy, much more politically engaged, and who really want to tell somebody how they feel about politics. And that big group of people in the middle who aren't that engaged in politics, who aren't that concerned in the outcome, they'll probably vote, but they're not that engaged in the process. Those are the ones we tend to miss.
And I want to ask you one more question from the point of view of the person who might be polled. How does somebody know if they're asked to participate in a poll, whether or not it's legitimate?
Well, there's a professional organization called APOR, which is the American Association for Public Opinion Research. And they have something called a Transparency Initiative, or TI, which is kind of our version of the good housekeeping seal about polling. And what somebody can do is they can just go onto the APOR site, and has a whole list of all of the organizations that have submitted the way that they conduct polls, submitted their willingness to share results and share data with other people. If an organization's name is on that list, I would say go ahead and talk with them. They're a legitimate organization that is in this for the right reasons. Now, they may not be perfect. You may have some issues with how they collect their data, but they are doing their best to be transparent about how they do it.
Andy, as you well know, many people are following each new poll very closely, feeling relieved when their candidate seems up and discouraged when their candidate seems down. I'm guessing that you would advise against that.
I absolutely would advise against that. I'd say that, you know, we're going to find out who wins or loses this election on the day after, or maybe the week after the election. And fretting about it in advance is just going to cause you heartache.
So why do polls? Stomach.
Well, the reason that we do polls is, frankly, it plays on human nature. Polls are clickbait. And this is, I think, one of the problems I think we see with polls. You got to go back to the 1930s when George Gallup was developing his American Institute for Public Opinion, which what we call the Gallup poll. And he promised newspapers that if they ran the Gallup poll, that they would see an increase in their circulation, which meant more revenue for them. Television got into this business in the 1960s and 70s for the same reasons. They figured out that when they ran a poll, when they put it on their newscast, people watched it more. It's human nature to want to see what the score is. Now we see so many polls that are out there that it's made it easy for media organizations to just put a poll out and it gets clicked on. So if you're in the media business, you know that there's somebody in your administration there that's watching all of the stories that you have on your website and seeing which ones are the most popular. You can go to news websites and they'll have a listing down the side of it to say which are the most popular stories. And if there's a new poll, it's almost at the top. So polls are essentially clickbait, and it's inexpensive clickbait for the media. People will go and click on that story, and each time that story gets clicked on, you hear a little ka-ching in the back of the financial background of the media organization, because that's paying the bills. That's the financial structure of the news media today, is through websites. And polls are just a very inexpensive way for the media to get their viewers, readers, listeners, whatever,
Andy, they
money.
Have to have some value beyond that, though. If for no other reason, I don't believe that you would dedicate your professional life to them if there wasn't some value to them.
Well, yes, there is that too. So I think polls are very interesting. First, to see the direction of thing, I like to look at the popularity of the candidates, the awareness who the candidates are, the issues that are of importance in an election, to see if and I think that serves a civic duty, that if you see that there are some issues that are very important but not being talked about by candidates, they'll often switch to that. And I go back to the 2008 presidential election when there was really a push, concern about, there was big concerns about opioids. And candidates weren't talking about opioids. They didn't have any messages about opioids and overdoses, but it was coming up in our polls. And it was coming up in also their campaign stops. And very quickly, all of those candidates started to have issue packages surrounding opioids and overdoses.
So if someone does answer a pollster, they have some power and have some, that is a way of getting the issue you care about to be talked about.
It certainly is. And I think that's what Gallup really talked about when he was first getting the writing about the Gallup poll and about these kind of the collective wisdom of the American people to understand what issues are most important to them. But trying to figure out who's going to win or who's going to lose this far out in a very close race, I think is really kind of silly. I would just say, don't look at the polls between now and the election. Just figure out it's like the ninth inning in a baseball game and it's going to be really close.
Bowdoin Professor Chris Potholm was on Maine Calling a couple weeks ago, and he encouraged us to pay attention to how a pollster winnows respondents. He believes that the polls who survey regular voters are the most accurate, not likely voters. Do you agree?
Well, it's hard to say because everybody has a different definition of what a regular voter is, a likely voter, a registered voter. In a state like New Hampshire, where you don't even have to be registered to vote, you can show up on election day and vote. And about 10% or 15% of our electorate do that on election day.
Yeah, I think he said people who told the pollster they always vote.
Yeah, those are, that's a, it's a difficult thing because one of the problems that we face in survey research, and again, survey research is not a so much a statistical profession as it is a psychological profession. We have something called social desirability, which is basically that we want to seem like we're doing things in the proper way. And we've been told since we were kids that voting is important, that we should vote. It's your civic duty to vote. And when somebody calls you up and asks you how likely you are to vote in the election, of course, we're going to say, oh, of course, I'm going to vote. And we've seen polls overestimate the intention of people's voting for as long as there have been polls. That we've been trying for decades, literally decades, a half a century or more, to try to figure out a way to get those people who are most likely to vote, who will actually show up on election day to respond to polls, and to get those other people who aren't going to vote to tell us that they're not going to vote. But we haven't been able to do it because it's the socially desirable thing to say that you vote.
How likely is it, Andy, in your view, in this election particularly, that people who don't usually vote will vote? How is the get out the vote ground game different and better this time around?
Well, I think that's one of the back to the future things that the whole political business has done over the last 30 years is that they've gone away from advertising as much and understanding that the ground game is really where it matters. There's quite a bit of research that's looked at this, that if you knock on somebody's door and talk with somebody, they're more likely to show up and they're more likely to support your candidate. And maybe not for president, but for down ticket races, because frankly, most people vote for the D or the R and their vote isn't that important to them in the sense that they, if you talk with them and you're polite and you say, okay, I'll vote for your candidate. You seem like a good person. So getting out the vote is an important thing to do. The people who haven't voted in the past are the least likely to vote because voting is a habit. That's why we try to get people to vote when they're young, to continue that habit of voting. It's harder to get somebody who's never voted before to actually get out and vote.
All right, Andy, we've been speaking primarily about the presidential polling, and that's what we see in the big papers all the time. But I want to ask you about Congress. Have you seen polling about Congress? And what do you believe, based on that polling, is likely to happen come November?
Well, in Congress, there's a couple things. One is this, what we call a generic congressional ballot, where we just ask people if they're going to vote for the Republican or Democratic candidate in their district. That's shown to be fairly predictive of the outcome of the election. It has somewhat of a Democratic bias because Democratic votes tend to be concentrated in certain areas and Republican votes tend to be spread out more across the country when you look at congressional districts. So you look at the maps for Congress or maps for voting, you see this big mass of red and little tiny pockets of blue across the state. So that's one thing that I think is helpful, but not exactly right. Congressional district polling is hard because so many people don't even know who their congressman is. Only about 40% of people can name their congressman. So they're voting for the R or the D in those races. And a lot of that tends to be straight ticket voting.
Only 40% of Americans can tell you who their congressperson is?
Yeah. Then when you get down to state representatives or state senators, it's even lower. In New Hampshire, we have 400 state representatives. The idea being that everybody's going to know who their state rep is and bump into them at the grocery store. Truth is, almost nobody knows who their state rep is.
Oh, my goodness. Well, last question. During the last two or three election cycles, how accurate have national polls been?
They've been getting worse and worse. The 2016 election was not that accurate. The 2020 was even worse. I was on a task force that looked at reasons for that. And what we found out is, frankly, to one of the early questions you asked, is that Republicans and Trump voters were the least likely or less likely to even talk with a reporter. And when they did, they were more likely to say either they weren't sure who they were going to vote for or they were going to vote for a third party candidate. And that gets back to that issue of social desirability. Trump was not seen as the popular candidate and people were less likely to report their support for Trump. This is a real problem. This is the core of the issue that we're facing in the survey research business is how to get people to give us honest answers without worrying about that social desirability component. We haven't figured it out.
Always so interesting to talk with you. Andy Smith directs the UNH Survey Center. He's also, of course, a professor at the University of New Hampshire. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks, Jennifer.